Imagine you are a Babylonian merchant. The year is 539 BC.
Right.
Your city's walls are just, you know, completely impenetrable. You live in the undisputed crown jewel of the ancient world.
The absolute center of civilization.
Yeah, exactly. And then an army of horse nomads just walks straight through your front gates. No siege, no firing a single arrow. They basically just hand you a massive tax cut and cheerfully inform you that your own god actually invited them in.
It is the ultimate historical plot twist.
It really is. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, our mission is to uncover how a distant group of nomadic horse riders, the Medes and the Persians, accidentally became the blueprint for modern government. And, well, how they literally saved Judaism.
Yeah, it's a massive story.
Right. And we're pulling all of this from a deeply insightful lecture by Dr. Anthony J. Tomasino. It's titled Judaism Before Jesus, Session 3, The Persian Empire.
And, you know, the Persians really represent this huge blind spot in our collective historical memory. Like, when you read ancient texts, especially the Old Testament, you hear endlessly about the Egyptians and the Babylonians. But the Persians, they're often just treated as this vague, distant mystery.
Yeah, they're just sort of in the background.
Exactly. But to understand how they built an empire that rivaled Babylon in size, we really have to look at who they were. These were Indo-Aryan peoples who migrated into the Middle East. And originally, they were purely nomadic.
So, guys on horseback.
Right. Horses were the absolute center of their culture, their military, their religion, everything. And when they finally settle down and unite, they don't just, you know, copy the empires that came before them. They engineer a completely different way of ruling human beings.
Okay, let's unpack this, because the standard ancient warlord playbook usually involves, like, burning cities to the ground and ruling through sheer terror.
Right, the Assyrian model.
Yeah, but the guy who kicks off the Persian Empire around 550 BC takes a totally different route. We are talking about Cyrus the Great.
Cyrus is fascinating. He actually begins his career by revolting against his own father-in-law.
Wow.
Yeah, a Median king named Astyages. But once Cyrus consolidates his power, he realizes something crucial. Ruling a massive territory through constant military oppression is exhausting. And it's incredibly expensive.
It drains the treasury.
Exactly. So he develops this strategy of radical tolerance. He keeps local rulers in power. He lets conquered populations keep their daily lives and customs. All he really asks is, you know, just pay your taxes to me.
It sounds so much like the ancient equivalent of a corporate raider doing a hostile takeover.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Right. Because instead of firing the entire staff and liquidating the assets, he walks in, gives every single employee a bonus, upgrades the break room, and then claims the old CEO's beloved mentor actually told him to do it.
That is exactly what happens with his conquest of Babylon in 539 BC. Babylon was the ultimate prize, but its king, this guy Nabonidus, had made a staggering unforced political error.
Like a massive PR blunder.
Oh, massive. Nabonidus decided to completely ignore the city's chief god, Marduk. And instead, he forced the population to worship the moon goddess Sin.
Which people generally don't love.
No, the priests were furious. And to make matters worse, while Cyrus is out there actively conquering the known world, Nabonidus just goes on a prolonged vacation.
He just left.
Yeah, he went to an oasis down in Arabia.
So the Babylonian king abandons his people, disrespects their most powerful priests, and basically creates a massive power vacuum. Right, as a brilliant strategist is marching toward the city.
Precisely. And Cyrus recognized that vulnerability immediately. He didn't need to break down the walls with siege engines. He fought a propaganda war.
Use PR.
Yes. When he enters Babylon, he releases what we now call the Cyrus Cylinder. It's essentially this massive ancient press release. And in it, Cyrus claims he didn't invade at all.
He was invited.
Right. He insists that Marduk, the very god Nabonidus ignored, came to Cyrus in a dream and begged him to liberate the city. So Cyrus comes in, frees the slaves, abolishes forced labor, and heavily funds the native temples.
And this strategy directly intersects with biblical history, doesn't it?
It does.
Because if you're funding native temples to win loyalty, that totally explains why the Jewish captives who had been exiled in Babylon were suddenly allowed to go home.
That exact policy is what funded the return of the Jewish exiles. Cyrus provided state funds for them to go back to Jerusalem and rebuild their temple. He even sends a man named Sheshbazzar, who was from the royal line of David, to lead the expedition.
Wow, so he's actively restoring their royal lineage.
Right. By returning their religious artifacts and funding their identity, Cyrus secured this deeply loyal population right on the edge of his empire.
Though looking at the sources, that return to Jerusalem wasn't exactly a perfect, harmonious homecoming.
Not at all.
Because you have these Jewish elites who have been living in Babylon for decades, right? They've accumulated wealth. They're speaking Aramaic now. And they show up in Jerusalem expecting to just reclaim their ancestral estates.
Yeah. And those properties aren't empty.
Exactly. They're occupied by the lower class locals who never left and are still speaking Hebrew.
The social friction was immense. You essentially had a wealthy Aramaic-speaking upper class clashing over land rights with a working class Hebrew-speaking population in a ruined city. It was incredibly messy.
Yeah, definitely not a fairy tale ending.
No. What's fascinating here is that despite all this massive success and carrying titles like King of the Four Corners of the Earth, Cyrus's actual tomb was remarkably austere.
Really? No giant pyramids?
No towering statues at all. Just a small, simple monument. The inscription basically politely asks future conquerors not to begrudge him his little patch of dirt.
That is a surprising level of self-awareness for a guy who conquered the world. But passing down a system built entirely on one man's diplomatic genius is, it's a massive structural vulnerability.
Oh, I sell his cards.
Right. What happens to this fragile web of Collins when the founder dies and hands the keys to a son who just doesn't understand the core product?
You get a complete systemic failure. Cyrus's son, Cambyses, takes the throne and immediately dismantles his father's careful PR strategy. In 525 BC, he invades Egypt, and he displays absolutely zero interest in religious tolerance.
The ultimate Nepo baby disaster.
Truly, according to Greek historians, Cambyses encounters the Apis bull. The Egyptians revered this bull as the literal living incarnation of the sun god Ra, and Cambyses supposedly just walks right up to the bull and stabs it to death.
Oh my God, that isn't just bad management. That is a calculated display of absolute terror designed to break the spirit of a newly conquered people.
Exactly. But by abandoning the strategy of tolerance, he creates instant enemies everywhere. And while he's busy offending all of Egypt, the empire back home completely destabilizes.
This is a fake king.
Yes, a wild succession crisis breaks out. This guy appears in Persia claiming to be Cambyses' murdered brother Bardia. History remembers him as Pseudo-Smerdis, or the fake king.
What a title.
And the very first thing this fake king does is declare a massive empire-wide tax holiday.
Which is just the ultimate desperate populist maneuver. I mean, if you have no legitimate claim to power, you buy the loyalty of the citizens by simply eliminating their financial burdens.
And it worked flawlessly in the short term. Cambyses hears about this rebellion, furiously rushes back to reclaim his throne, but he mysteriously dies on the journey.
Convenient.
Very. The official story later recorded was suicide, but the Greek historian Herodotus claimed Cambyses accidentally pricked himself with his own sword as he mounted his horse. Supposedly in the exact same spot on his leg where he had stabbed the Apis bull.
Ah, a highly convenient narrative of divine retribution. So the founder is dead, the incompetent heir is dead, and an imposter is rapidly draining the treasury to buy public favor. Pulling a global empire back from the brink of total collapse requires more than just another charismatic leader.
It requires a permanent machine.
Right. And enter Darius the Great.
Yes. Darius steps into that void. He claims to be a distant cousin of Cyrus, forms a pact with 7 Persian nobles, and they march into the palace and assassinate the fake king.
Okay, wait. I am stuck on the story of how Darius actually claims the throne after that assassination. Because the Greek sources claim these 7 nobles decided who would be the new emperor by having a horse contest.
Yes, the famous horse neighing contest.
Right. Whoever's horse neighed and emerged from its stall first at sunrise got to rule the known world. Come on, wasn't this just a convenient myth to cover up a ruthless political coup? You're telling me the man who invents complex tax codes was chosen by a vocal horse?
Your skepticism is entirely justified. It was almost certainly a ruthless backroom political coup.
Right, obviously.
But we have to analyze why Darius chose that specific cover story. Remember the origins of the Persian people? They were Indo-Aryan nomads who held a deep, almost divine reverence for their horses.
Oh, so it spoke to their core identity.
Exactly. To the Persian public, a decision made by a horse wasn't random chance. It was the indisputable will of the gods. Darius used a culturally brilliant piece of propaganda to legitimize his power grab. And once his power is secure, he transitions the empire from a personality cult into a bureaucratic machine.
So how does he actually stabilize a territory that massive and that fractured?
By standardizing the mechanics of daily life, Darius creates a single universal coin called the Doric.
Okay.
Before this, local economies were completely separate. By introducing a standardized currency, he intertwined the economies of conquered nations. If a territory rebelled, they would crash their own market. He then divides the empire into 20 satrapies, or administrative districts.
And a satrapy isn't just a district drawn on a map. I mean, he installed local governors who actually spoke the language of the people they were managing.
Right.
Which totally removes the constant daily friction of foreign military occupation.
Precisely. But to prevent those local governors from gaining too much independent power, Darius created the world's first comprehensive postal system.
Just blew my mind.
It's incredible. He established relay stations with riders on horseback so messages could cross the empire in days instead of months. The motto of the American Pony Express, "Neither rain nor snow, nor dark of night," derives directly from a Greek historian describing Darius's Persian mail carriers.
So the postal system wasn't just about delivering letters. It was a mechanism of control. It allowed Darius to micromanage governors from thousands of miles away before they could even organize a rebellion.
It was an absolute revolution in logistics, if we connect this to the bigger picture. Darius's obsession with organization and standardization had a profound unintended consequence. It accidentally saved Jewish identity.
Okay, walk me through the mechanics of that. How does standardizing mail and tax codes preserve a religion?
Because Darius applied that exact same demand for standardization to local laws. He required the laws of his empire to be codified and written down.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Before Darius, if you were a Jewish person living in Persia, you might observe the Sabbath or dietary laws slightly differently than a Jewish person living in Egypt or Judea.
Right. It's probably very regional.
Exactly. Darius forced them to get on the same page. By demanding a single codified set of Jewish laws for the imperial records, he inadvertently homogenized the religion. He ensured that Jewish populations spread across the known world were all reading the exact same texts and keeping the exact same customs.
That is wild.
He also officially funded the completion of the Jerusalem temple under the leader Zerubbabel in 515 BC.
It is genuinely fascinating that the strict, unbending survival of ancient Jewish religious law was heavily enforced by a Persian bureaucrat who essentially just wanted his paperwork properly filed.
Literally just checking boxes.
Yeah. But even a perfect bureaucracy had limits. And Darius's machine eventually hits a wall it simply cannot absorb.
The Greeks.
Right, the Greeks.
The conflict begins with the Ionian Revolt, where Greek colonies situated within Persian territory rebel against the bureaucracy. Darius attempts to suppress them, which leads to the famous Battle of Marathon in 490 BC.
26 miles.
Right. The Greeks achieve a stunning victory, and a messenger supposedly runs 26 miles back to Athens to deliver the news before collapsing, which is the historical origin of the modern marathon.
And Darius dies before he can mount a proper retaliation.
Yes, passing the conflict to his son, Xerxes.
Now, when we hear the name Xerxes, the image that usually comes to mind is the giant, hairless, golden god king from the movie 300.
Oh, of course.
But the historical reality of Xerxes is very different from that ancient Greek spin.
Completely different. Persian kings absolutely did not claim to be gods. That was a Greek concept projected onto Xerxes to frame him as a monstrous megalomaniac for domestic propaganda.
To make him the ultimate villain.
Right. However, Xerxes was decidedly more ruthless than Cyrus or Darius. When Babylon revolted against Xerxes, he didn't try to win their hearts. He took the golden statue of Marduk, the same god Cyrus had so carefully respected, and melted it down into slag.
A calculated display of absolute terror to remind everyone who was in charge. So Xerxes gathers this massive army to finally crush the Greeks. But the military mismatch here really reveals the hidden cost of the Persian model.
It does.
A decentralized empire built on tolerance doesn't produce a unified nationalistic army. The Persian forces are largely unarmored conscripts and mercenaries drawn from dozens of conquered territories. They are just there to collect a paycheck.
Yeah, their hearts aren't in it.
Exactly. And they are crashing into heavy bronze Greek phalanxes, fighting for the literal survival of their homeland. Intense national pride versus just doing a job.
And that lack of unified motivation is exactly why the sheer numbers of the Persian army failed against the heavy Greek infantry. And while Xerxes is experiencing these military failures abroad, we start to see the strict limits of Persian religious tolerance back home.
The Zoroastrian influence, right?
Yes. By this time, the state religion was Zoroastrianism, centered on the supreme god Ahura Mazda. While generally tolerant, Zoroastrianism held a hard line against anything it categorized as a demon or a daiva. Xerxes issued the Daiva inscription, proudly recording that he actively sought out and violently destroyed the sanctuaries of these perceived demons to enforce Zoroastrian supremacy.
Here's where it gets really interesting. This era of Xerxes' court presents one of the most intriguing historical puzzles. Because the biblical story of Queen Esther, the Jewish queen, who famously risks her life to save her people from genocide, is set in the exact court of King Xerxes.
It is.
But historical records from outside the Bible detail a very different primary wife sitting next to the king, Queen Amestris.
Yes, and Queen Amestris was notoriously terrifying. When she discovered Xerxes was having an affair, she didn't just attack the woman involved. She had the woman's mother violently mutilated and paraded in public as a brutal warning.
That is just horrifying.
It was. Later in life, she reportedly had noble Persian youths buried upside down alive as an offering to underworld gods. Reconciling the noble narrative of Esther with the brutal historical reality of Queen Amestris existing in the exact same royal court remains a profound challenge for historians.
Definitely a stark contrast. So direct military force completely fails against the Greeks at massive battles like Salamis and Plataea. And if you can't beat them face to face, you have to change tactics.
Or you have to get deeply, dangerously creative.
Right. And the Persian pivot here introduces a completely new era of warfare, but one with devastating internal consequences.
Artaxerxes takes over and realizes that bleeding Persian soldiers on Greek soil is a total waste of resources. So he simply starts funding the enemies of the Greeks.
Which is like the ancient invention of the geopolitical proxy war. The Greeks start fighting each other, staging grand rebellions, entirely unaware that the rival factions are holding spears suspiciously stamped with Made in Persepolis.
Exactly. Artaxerxes just sits back and writes checks to keep his enemies divided. And this strategy extended to his borders as well. He is the king who commissions the biblical figures Ezra and Nehemiah to go back to Jerusalem and finally rebuild the city's defensive walls. He provides them with crucial imperial timber to fend off local opposition.
But ruling through checkbooks and proxy wars has a profound side effect.
It really does. The empire enters what historians politely call its cultural phase.
Meaning they stop fighting and start building.
Yes, they build magnificent palaces, beautiful things, but the actual management of the government rots from within. Relying on wealth and backroom deals rather than military strength breeds intense paranoia. We see later Persian kings attempting to secure the throne by assassinating 8 of their own half-brothers at a time.
Wow. I mean, if you are a king who is completely terrified that your own family or your top generals might start a rival dynasty, you stop trusting the competent people around you.
You have to.
You start looking for advisors who biologically cannot overthrow you, which perfectly explains the rise of the royal eunuchs.
Exactly the logic they followed. Because a eunuch couldn't produce heirs, the kings believed they couldn't possibly start a rival dynasty. The kings assumed the eunuchs were entirely dependent on the throne and therefore perfectly safe to trust with sweeping imperial powers.
But when you give individuals that much absolute power, and they have no family legacy to protect or lose, they realize they don't need to wear the crown. They just need to control the person wearing it.
Which brings us to Bagoas, the ultimate kingmaker.
Oh, this guy.
Bagoas weaponized his position to poison King Artaxerxes III. He then installed a puppet king, only to murder him as well when he proved inconvenient.
Just cleaning house.
Pretty much. Bagoas finally installed Darius III, assuming he would be just another easily controlled puppet. But Darius III figured out the game. Recognizing that Bagoas was preparing to poison him next, Darius physically forced Bagoas to drink his own poison.
Incredible. But by the time Darius III secures his own throne from his own staff, the damage is irreversible.
Completely.
The empire is totally hollowed out. It is mismanaged, corrupt, and exhausted from decades of internal paranoia. And that explains how a young Macedonian king named Alexander the Great could sweep across the map so quickly.
He didn't have to fight a strong empire.
Right. In 332 BC, Alexander doesn't defeat a thriving superpower. He kicks in a rotting door, shatters the Persian army, and the Achaemenid Empire falls.
But the Persian legacy does not vanish with Alexander's conquest. Their cultural DNA, specifically that radical religious tolerance derived from Zoroastrianism, survives the fall of the empire.
So where does that DNA actually go?
The Persian empires that followed the Parthian Empire and later the Sassanid Empire, they carried that Zoroastrian torch for centuries. Under the Sassanids in particular, Judaism thrived in the East.
Because they were protected.
Exactly. Furthermore, early Christianity was largely tolerated. these Zoroastrian rulers provided a protective umbrella. While the Roman Empire was often actively persecuting Christians, the Sassanid Persian Empire allowed these nascent religious communities to grow, to explore deep intellectual pursuits, and to firmly establish their theology.
So what does this all mean for you listening right now? It means that the next time you drop a letter in the mail and expect it to arrive across the country, or the next time you pay for a coffee using standardized currency, or even the next time you open a Judeo-Christian text, you are relying on systems engineered by a group of ancient horse nomads who figured out that tolerance and organization could build something stronger than a sword.
And that leaves us with a profound historical irony to consider.
Yeah.
That immense Zoroastrian tolerance is the very reason early Judaism and Christianity were able to survive and flourish during their most vulnerable centuries. Yet, centuries later, Zoroastrianism was driven to the absolute brink of extinction during the Arab conquests of the 7th century.
Because of a lack of tolerance.
Precisely because those later conquerors refused to extend that exact same tolerance back to them, deeming the Zoroastrians not a people of the book.
Wow. A sobering reminder of how quickly the rules of history can change on the very people who wrote them. Thank you so much for joining us as we unpack the blueprint of the Medes and Persians today. Until next time, keep diving deep.